Richard, I'll just say first, big thank you for taking your time for the interview.
That's all right, it's a pleasure.
First, I'm going to ask is, obviously, at this moment, Right Said Fred have been going for quite a long time, and you're still...
Yes.
You're still making music today. What is it that, at the moment, what do you say keeps you going on music? What is it that inspires you to keep making music?
To be honest with you, it's nothing to do with the business. It's just to do with writing songs. If we write a song that we like, then we find ourselves wanting to record it and then wanting to promote it. That's all it is. I'm not really terribly in love with the business side of it, or the celebrity side of it, if you like. That doesn't really motivate us at all. It never has, to be honest. Although that's where we found ourselves right at the beginning. That's not where we started. So it's really just writing songs. We found a couple of songs actually the other day that we'd written them about 10 years ago. Both sort of swing tracks, but they're actually surprisingly good. We're talking about re-recording them because they're really good. So it's that, really. It's just coming up with ideas. And also when you watch other artists perform and you just think, yeah, if I was watching Levon Helm the other day, the drummer with the band, and watching Van Morrison and people like that, and you just think, actually, these guys were really, really, really good. And that inspires you as well, other performers. Having said that, there aren't many contemporary performers that I get that feeling from, sadly. But if you go back in a few years, there are some absolutely staggering performers. And also stand-up. Stand-up I find quite inspiring too. Good stand-up, original stand-up. Again, it's not terribly common these days.
Listening to music now, who would you say would be generally on your, who do you listen to on your iPod? Who would you be listening to now?
Well, the thing I listen to most in terms of current stuff is MGMT and Kids,
okay.
which I really like, and I like it because it's got a great keyboard riff in it. I like the way they've treated the vocal, and I like the way they've managed to make not such a great song a 5 minutes worth of good music, which is half the skill. You can't write the best song every 5 minutes. The skill is to make a second-rate song sound like a first-rate song. And MGMT I really like. I've listened to a lot of Johnny Cash, the last album he did, When the Man Comes Around, which was produced by Rick Rubin. And there aren't many current performers that I quite like bits of the Killers, I suppose. I find a lot of it lacking in humour, and I find a lot of it to be a bit derivative, to be absolutely honest with you. There's, when I was a kid and I watched Captain Beefheart and Roxy Music and all that stuff was so out there and so bizarre. That's what got me interested in it in the first place. And you don't see that so much now. It's got a little bit like stand-up. I think the whole thing is, you can wrap the whole thing up in one bag, if you like. It's all become very conservative and risk-free, which is why Michael McIntyre is so popular. The days of Spike Milligan and those guys are temporarily, sadly, gone. So anything that's weird tends to attract my attention. I really like Sam Leonard Cohen, all sorts of stuff. Also, I'm just trying to remember the last thing I listened to. Actually, the last thing I listened to was Caravan, which was sung by Van Morrison in 1970-something, live with the band, and his vocal is just absolutely staggeringly good. You forget how good these guys were. Really, really good. So nothing contemporary, sadly. I'd like to sound more modern, but I can't.
This is something that I only didn't know until a little while ago, is that starting off, you and Fred, you both actually started as musicians with people like Bob Dylan, David Bowie. What was it like actually playing with them people?
Well, it was Fred actually played with Bob Dylan. He actually did a very short tour on a movie with Bob Dylan. And Fred was much more involved musically with Bob Dylan than I was with. I did some stuff with David Bowie and I did some stuff with Mick Jagger. But it was more as a Ponty poser, to be absolutely honest with you. But it was, the thing about it was, the thing that really struck home with me with all these guys was that they're just people. Mick Jagger has to drop his pants and take a poo. They're just people. They're just people. And it really struck home with me that although I loved early Bowie stuff and I really liked some of the, not so much now, but I really liked some of the early Stone stuff. But they are just people. And they make their own choices and they make their own decisions and they tend not to look around too much at what everybody else is doing. They tend to follow their own nose, which is something which I think musicians should do. I don't think it's a good idea to pay too much attention to what everybody else is doing. So it was inspiring. I mean, it, you know, the Mick Jagger, it was a while ago now, but he must have been, how old was he then? He probably would have been mid-50s, I suppose, when I worked with him. Mid-50s of 60 or something. And he was, I mean, so full of energy. It was amazing. Absolutely staggering, really, the amount of energy he had. And of all the frontmen, I think he's probably my favourite frontman and singer. Not because he's got the greatest voice, but because I think he understands songs really well, and he's a great lyricist. And also he understands what he needs to do to make the song believable. And it doesn't necessarily mean hitting a top C, which is, to me, completely beyond. I don't understand why singers feel the need to do this. I think it's partly the sort of, you know, the sort of Britain's Got Talent, American Idol, UK Idol, Britain's Got Talent, X Factor rubbish, where people think that you know, the scale and that you know, your range is the issue, and that is not the issue. It never has been the issue, and never will be. The issue is whether you can communicate the idea to people, and if you can do that with one note, why use two? So that's but working with those people was really inspiring. It was interesting, and it was, you know, it was very exciting. I mean, I was a kid at the time, and I didn't know anything. I had no idea how videos were made or how these people worked. I had no idea. So it was frightening and exciting at the same time.
Because a lot of people look up to your music now, especially going over 20 years on now. When you brought out the song "I'm Too Sexy," what was going through your mind when you first released that? Did you expect it to be as big of a hit as it was?
No, I didn't think anybody would buy it, frankly. I didn't think it would sell a single copy. There were two moments when I realised that maybe this was going to be a hit. One was when we had a bass player called Phil Spaulding, who was probably the best bass player I've ever worked with. And he put the bass down. We originally had the bass guitar. It was all the bass part, rather, was put down on keyboards. So it was sounding fine. But when Phil put the live bass on it, and he was a really precise and sympathetic player. And when I heard the live bass, I thought, actually, this is sounding really good. I still thought it was a bit odd. I still didn't think anybody would buy it. But I liked the fact that live bass brought the track alive. And then the second time it struck me was when we flew to Brussels. We had a promotion show in Belgium. And that's when it first struck me that you could have a hit outside your own country. It never crossed my mind. Never crossed my mind for a single second that anybody outside the UK would ever hear it. And then we were taken off to go to Brussels, and I remember thinking, oh, Christ, of course. You can have a hit all over the world. This is amazing. And then, of course, it was number one in America, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Went on from there. But nobody was more surprised than us. And any artist that tells you they think they know when they've got a hit, I think he's either an idiot or a liar, one of the two. It's always a surprise. And you can never tell what people like. You know, you can never tell what they get off on. It's very, very... And that's what makes it so challenging, in a way. It's you know, most artists, you operate in the dark. You don't really know for sure whether punters are going to dig what you do or not. It's a horse race. But that's what makes it exciting and frustrating at the same time, you know.
I mean, the song itself was apparently the first number one from a debut artist song to get to number one since the Beatles. I mean, how does that feel when you get told that? You think no other British act apart from you was able to then do what the Beatles did.
Well, the weird thing was, and I don't want this to sound sort of arrogant or anything, but at the time I just didn't get it. You know, I didn't get it. I heard, you know, this is America's number one, like Sir Fred, and I, you know, we were riding around in Thunderbirds and living it up and going over to America and doing sort of shows and PR and all that kind of stuff. But I just didn't get it. I didn't understand how special that was. I really didn't. And I think probably because it happened so quickly. I mean, the time span between release in the UK and number one in America was less than a year, about a year, maybe a bit less. And so the first 9 months or 10 months were obviously us running all over the world, you know, the UK and Europe and God knows where else. Then we had to go to America, and I think it happened so quick. we just didn't get it. And I didn't, I never felt better about myself just because we had a hit record. So, you know, I never felt like a star particularly. I never particularly thought that I was any good, really, to be honest. I found the whole thing a bit mysterious. It was only when we went back to Germany in 2001, we had a big hit album and a few hit singles then, in the early part of the 2000s, 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's when I really started to enjoy it, because I understood the business much more, and I understood what was expected of us much more. So I was very naive. I didn't. Although I was over 30, I mean, I just didn't get it. I just really didn't get it. I found the whole thing a real. It was a game. Well, it was a game then, but I didn't see it like that. I understand now that it's a game, but at the time, I didn't understand. Yeah, why it was successful, I couldn't quite figure it out. But Sexy was selling 100,000 copies a day, and it did that for 10 weeks. It's extraordinary. I mean, you couldn't get. I mean, I look back, I can't get my head around it.
From when you released your debut album up to your most recent work, do you feel that your style has stayed quite similar, or do you feel that you've grown and changed with each release?
No, I don't think. No, I think sometimes we are not other artists, but we've regressed sometimes. I mean, sometimes some of the best stuff we did is early, and then some of the newer stuff has been. Some of the newer stuff has been better than the old stuff, but not recognised as such. It's a bit of both. I mean, I think some of the stuff we did in the early days, what I love about it is it's simple and it's very, very unassuming and tongue in cheek without being knowingly funny. And I love all that. I really, really like that. I'm very proud of what we did. But the stuff we did in Germany, which is actually more successful than some of the early stuff in Germany, at least, and also in America, some of the recent dance mixes we've had have been very successful. And the whole thing is trying to be simple. That is the whole thing. The minute I watch Jamie Cullum putting a flattened ninth on a chord because he's playing some jazz, I just turn off. I can't be dealing with it. You've got to be. It's, remember John Lennon saying, the minute he got too good or too accomplished on the guitar, he started playing piano. Because when you're writing pop music, you have to strip it right down. You have to absolutely. It's got to be. One of my favourite singles is No Trio, the Da Da Da, because it is so simple. It is so. That simplicity is actually very hard to do. It's much easier to do really complicated stuff. But trying to pare it down and strip it right out so that you've got. That's why Buddy Holly is still so inspiring, because the songwriting is so simple and yet so good. And it's like, you know, there are many artists that can do both. Elton John was one who could do both, I think. He could write, with Bernie Taupin, he could write pop music that was intricate and clever. But there aren't many people that can do that. And for me, pop music has always been the stuff I've loved. It's like early, you know, Mark Bowman. It's just that really, really, really simple stuff. I love it. I absolutely love it. And it's a real challenge. You know, you come up with an idea, anything clever, bin it. Absolutely. They call it killing your own children. It's very important.
In the US, you have been getting quite a regular rotation, especially on your most recent music. What do you feel is your appeal for people? What is it that you think why people keep coming back and listening to your music?
I think in America we're sort of underground. I know it sounds a bit weird, but we're considered to be a little bit odd. And in America, I think that if you're going to go to America as an artist, you have to take to America something that they can't get themselves. There's no point going to America as a close harmony country band, because they can do that all day long and they do it better. There's no point in going to America as a I don't think it personally these days, not so much in the old days, but certainly now, as a guitar based rock band, because they do that stuff really, really well. But if you're gonna go to America, take something, have an attitude or an image or something. That's why Boy George was saying huge over there. Because it was something they couldn't have that they or not couldn't have that they didn't have, they couldn't make themselves. So I think that's one of the reasons. I also think that some of the remixes we've done recently are really good. We have a guy in America called David Levine who has been working his nuts off for us for about 4 years. And he was the marketing head of Casablanca, which was a very successful independent label in the 80s. and he's left and now doing his own thing. And he's been working really hard. So I think it's a bit of both. I think it's partly the music, it's partly the image, it's partly the fact that we don't court celebrity, perhaps as much as some people think we should. We're a bit more reclusive, I suppose. And David's bloody hard work. You know, he gets up early and works real late and goes out to clubs and bangs on doors and does all that. He's got a real old-fashioned work ethic, which is something the music business now lacks. There are lots, and it's full of incredibly lazy people who think that who are looking for the one big chance. But the truth is, in the music business, that 9 times out of 10, it's just hard work. It's just boring day-to-day hard work. That's what it is. It's a shortcut.
Right. Next question I've got. This is one that when I saw you on this really intrigued me. You was on a couple of years ago on the Ricky Gervais comedy Life's Too Short. How did that come around?
Well, that was they just phoned us basically. They emailed. I think they emailed my brother, and he phoned me up, and I sort of made a bit of a face, and I was a bit. I think, I don't know why, but I said, well, who else is on it? I don't see why we should do this. Who else is on it? Partly because we get used to being given a whole load of to do. And Fred said, well, there's Johnny Depp and there's Liam Neeson and there's, and I said, okay, well, then I think we should do it. And it was a great day. Ricky Gervais was lovely. Literally, that just came straight to us. We then phoned him up and said, are you sure that we're the people you mean? Do you really want to do this? And they said, yeah, we only want to work with people that we dig. And we dig you guys. So we said, great. And we did it. We did a base filming out in West London somewhere. And I really enjoyed it. Actually, I really, really enjoyed it. And as I say, Rick and Steve were both very, very friendly. And there was no side to them. It was very, very, just very easy to talk to. And it made the whole day go very easily. I mean, I really enjoyed it. The funny thing was we just, that was a good example of how we are in the UK. We did that. I don't think we got a single radio interview or a single TV interview on the basis of that. I don't recall anything happening around that at all. So then that happens to us quite a bit. We do things and we sort of pop up and then disappear, maybe that's us. Maybe it's the people we work with. I've got no idea. I really don't know. But I enjoyed it. The Ricky Gervais thing was great. And my personal favourite was the Liam Neeson sketch.
That was actually quite memorable.
I thought, when he wanted to be a stand-up comedian. just didn't understand, cancer jokes aren't funny. And he didn't understand it. He couldn't get it. And I thought Ricky Gervais and Steve Urchin were very, very funny. That particular episode was my favourite. I thought the Johnny Depp thing was a little bit overworked, to be honest. I didn't think that worked for me. But probably it's just a personal thing.
You've been to a lot of gigs. You've done a lot of gigs. Has there been anything that's stuck out in your mind that you remember? Something that was maybe a bit strange or a bit funny? What has there been any experience that's really stuck with you?
There's a few. When we first started doing, we did the Radio 1 in the days when Radio 1 actually played music that people wanted to hear, and they had huge audiences. They did the Radio 1 Roadshow, which I thought was a great idea. It was taking the show and the DJs out on the road. So they would do Rill and they would do Brighton and they would do, Scotland, and they'd take it all over the country. And Radio 1 was the national pop station, and they tried to make it consistent with that image by actually taking the whole thing on the road. We did quite a few Radio 1 road shows, and I can remember, I can't remember which show it was, but I remember we walked out on stage just to lip sync I'm Too Sexy. It was going up the charts, blah, blah, blah. And there was about 50 or 60,000 people there, and every single person stood up. That was one time I remember thinking, this is quite extraordinary. And then the other time was in America. We did a gig at a biker's club. It was like a Hell's Angels biker's club. And it was one of those clubs where they actually have the chicken wire in front of the stage, which you can pull down if it looks like you're going to get stuff thrown at you. They can pull this chicken wire down. I think it was in the Blues Brothers.
Yes, that's what I was just thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just like that. And we get there with our tour manager, and I was Wally, and I had this white see-through body stocking thing to wear. And I said to Wally, I said, I'm going to get killed here. This is an absolute joke. This is a nightmare. I mean, first of all, why are we here? And two, they're going to bloody hate it. And he said, well, it's too late now. You've got half the money, and you know, you're on in 2 hours, so you better just lap it up. So we went out, and I wore this see-through body stocking thing down in Texas or somewhere. I can't remember where it was. And they absolutely loved it. The guys were fucking brilliant. I mean, they were really... Everybody was incredibly friendly, and it was a great night. I don't remember ever seeing a woman there, actually. I think it was all blokes, pretty much, with beards and leather clothes, all their bikes outside. You know, it was a proper club, and it was and I was expecting to get beaten up, and we didn't. And that was so. That was another. There's that, and the other one in the UK. Most of them. I mean, a lot of the geeks. You know, they all sort of meld into one. I do remember when we did the World Cup in Germany a few years ago. That was in Berlin. I just can't remember the name of the... It's a particular place and a particular address in Berlin. I can't remember where it was now. Anyway, and there was about 250,000 people there. I should never forget that. You couldn't see the end. You couldn't see the end of, you know, where the people were. We were opening up to the World Cup, and that was pretty extraordinary. So there's been a few, you know, supporting Status Quo. It came out 3 years ago, and there's been a few that I recall. Funnily enough, I remember gigs in the early days more than I remember the good ones. I remember all the crappy gigs we did in Covent Garden and North London and touring with Suicide and all that kind of stuff and the Joy Division and all that, you know, some of that stuff I remember very clearly because it was so painful to do. The good stuff you tend to forget for some reason, I don't know why.
This is one that I don't know if you'll take a second to think about, because I know obviously you've worked with some brilliant people, but if you got given the opportunity to make a record with someone or just to get to perform with, who would you choose and why would you choose that person?
Whoa. That's a good question. I think that, first of all, there's production. The working with a producer that teaches you stuff would be really exciting. Somebody like Rick Rubin, somebody who is not normally, wouldn't normally be associated with what you do, would be an interesting thing. In terms of performers, it's actually quite difficult because performers are very selfish, and so obviously my favourite would be Mick Jagger, but the problem is everybody would be looking at him. That's the problem. So maybe if there was a really, really famous but crap performer out there, maybe I'd choose them. I don't know. There aren't many, I don't think. I mean, most of the people I would want to work with would have to be a bit odd. They'd have to be a little bit out there, I think. Most of the performers who are famous currently are, for me at least, a little bit mundane, I suppose, is the best word. You know, not being critical, really. It's just the way that they are. I suppose Laurie Anderson, you know, people like that, or Leonard Cohen, or David Byrne, people who just have a skewed view of the world, as opposed to a lot of the pop stuff which we have now, which is very orthodox and very predictable. That doesn't interest me at all. So it would be difficult. I mean, with Don't Talk to Kiss, we worked with Jocelyn Brown. And it's a weird thing working with other players. It's a weird thing. I saw in the paper the other day that Mick Hutton and Joss Stone have re-recorded the first Beatles album, I think I'm right in saying.
Really?
I think they've apparently. I can't think of a more complete and utter waste of time than that. It's a bit like, if you're a painter, why would you go and repaint the Mona Lisa? I don't understand that. You know, you're a painter and you think highly of what you do, and you go out and you repaint the Hay Lane, or you repaint, oh, I don't know, or something by Lucian Freud. I just think it's a complete bloody waste of time. But I think that's what they've done. And I think they both should be shot for it. It's a crap idea. Total But no, performers, no, it's hard. It's hard. They're, you know, if you watch, the thing about performers, which I think is really interesting, is if you watch some guys from, you know, kids tend to, it's about, you know, popular culture has a very short attention span and a very short memory. And so when you talk about people like Spike Milligan, or you talk about the Goons, or you talk about the guy that sung Minnie the Moocher, what coming his name now, people don't really understand what you're talking about. They don't, you know, it's not in their compass. But a lot of these performers, a lot of these stand-ups, I watched some Tommy Cooper the other day, I mean, the guy was completely bonkers, absolutely mad. And I love that. I really, really love it. I like watching the Goons. I love watching Peter Cook, Elton Moore. You know, in terms of stand-up, there's not many out there that are doing anything truly original now. They substitute volume for wit. And the same is true of performers. I did an interview with Janice Long, I don't know, about a year ago, and I said, you know, where are all the weird performers? Where are the people out there where you look at it and you think, my God, where's that come from? And she said, they're all out there. They're all in clubs and bars and pubs all over the country. But she said, you just won't hear them on the radio. And that's a shame. It's a real shame. We should value people like Morrissey is a good example. Not one of my all-time favourites, but a completely unique performer. Mark Harmon, just the same. Unique performers, but we don't value them enough over here, sadly.
No, I do believe that's true. I think Morrissey as well, I know that he does still get a lot of appreciation, but I think even he's probably not, I don't think he's ever hit a peak to what he deserves.
No, I don't think so. I think people in the UK, well, that's why he lives in America. Not so much, I think. I mean, I remember doing a TV show with Lemmy from Motorhead, and he was on the panel, and it was one of those TV shows where they take the and I find that funny personally. I think it's cool. I don't mind having the taken out of me. It doesn't bother me. But because he lives and works in work in America exclusively, but certainly lives there, I think he found the whole thing extremely insulting, and in the end got up and walked off. And there is that huge psychological cultural difference between the way we regard, you know, musicians and celebrity in the UK and the way they do in America. In America, they take it very seriously. It's a business. It's connected with show business, and it's to be taken seriously. And it's, you know, you don't take the out of yourself. You treat what you do with some kind of weight, and you don't belittle it. In the UK, we expect famous people to run themselves down a little bit and not to get too big-headed. That's a very English thing. So there is this huge gap, and I think with someone like Morrissey, I think he feels more comfortable living in America. I think he feels he gets gets respect that he thinks he deserves. And I frankly, I don't blame him. I mean, any artist that decides not to live here, I think, you know, I wouldn't criticise him for it, because I think the UK is strangely, I don't know what the word would be. We spend far too much time rattling on about Girls Aloud and nowhere near enough time rattling on about, oh, I don't know, Beck or Morrissey or Mark Almond or whoever. And, you know, we don't, that eccentricity, we don't value it high enough. We've become incredibly bland, I think, in the UK, in comedy and in pop. It needs shaking up. The whole thing needs shaking up. In fact, if there was a bunch of 16-year-olds out there who couldn't play but were shouting like, I'd probably sign them. Because that's what it needs. It needs that punk thing all over again. It needs to be shaken up. But it ain't going to happen, I don't think. I don't think it's going to happen now. So it's just down to performance. You have to try and get out and do what you do. Some of the stuff we do is very predictable. Some of the stuff it's not. You know, some of the stuff I'm proud of, some of the stuff I'm not. It's, you know, we're just everybody else in that way. Sometimes you have a good day and sometimes you don't. But I just wish we were a little bit more prepared to entertain the bizarre nature of things. It's nice to see Adamant out there doing stuff again, because he was a bizarre performer.
Yeah, I actually went to go and see him more than a couple of months. Went to go and see him in the summer, and I thought, considering everything that, you know, you hear in the papers, you hear it all, like personal turmoil and things like that, but I thought he got on stage, he did his show, he impressed everyone, he made a big impact, and at the end of the day, I think that is all that matters.
It is, absolutely. The thing is, it doesn't matter what it is, whether you're, you know, you could be, you know, if, you know, whether it's an acoustic show, whether you're jumping, you know, riding a motorbike over 20 buses or whatever it happens to, people have paid money and they come to see you. That's it. And, you know, when you get up on stage, you must try and remember that. We had a manager some years ago, and we were doing some in Blackpool, I think it was, a real dump. And we were really pissed off, he could tell. He came to the dressing room, we were all sitting there with faces like a week of wet Sundays. And he said, this is a show. And he said, I don't care, but even if one person turns up, it's a show. You get out there and you do a show. And he was absolutely right. Absolutely right. Doesn't matter how many people are there. What's important is what you play, not where you play. Too many performers are obsessed with where they play rather than what they play. And I think it's important to remember what you play. That's the key thing. And if that takes you to Wembley, that's great. If it doesn't take you to Wembley, that's also great. But you've got to be sort of true to yourself as much as you can and not play to the gallery too much.
Well, Richard, thank you so, so much. And I'll tell you what, I think I've probably learned a lot more in this interview than what I could have possibly imagined.
Well, I think that's very sweet of you to say so. As any performer will tell you, it's changed on all recognition in the last 5 years. I mean, but since we started in the last 20 years, I mean, you can't, it's incredible the difference now. And for artists, it's very, one thing I would say to anybody who hears this is if you're going to listen to music and buy music, please pay for it. Please, please, please pay for it. Doesn't matter. Even if it's just, you know, you have 75p for one single, don't stream it. Don't download it illegally. Pay for it. Because the one thing that's killing music and killing artists' ability to make music is the fact that people are not paying for it. I know one writer, a very successful writer, who is now has had to emigrate because he can't make any money. I mean, he made all his money from writing songs, and of course that was based on sales, and now sales are through the floor. And he's a very talented player and a very talented songwriter, and it's very difficult for him to make money. And there are lots and lots of people out there like that. And it's being driven by people who will pay £3 for a cappuccino but won't pay 79p for a record that might last them their whole lifetime.
Yeah.
So pay for it. If you want it, pay for it.
Very, very true. And definitely, definitely, I think that is what is killing a lot of music. And hopefully people will learn and then it will go back to its heyday as it was.
It will do. Yes, it will. I mean, ultimately, people will, in the end, they will want something that surprises them. They will want something more than Leona Lewis. They will want something more than Robbie Williams. They're going to want something more interesting and more challenging than what they're currently getting. And it will take time. It will. You're absolutely right. It will take time, but it will come round. And the performers that are sadly lacking now, or missing, rather, they're all out there. Some of them might be 2 years old or 3 years old or 5 years old right now, but they are out there. And hopefully we'll all be around to hear them more from, you know, when they start making some money and people appreciate them for what they are. It would be a very happy day.
Fantastic. Well, Richard, I'm going to let you go now. Thank you so much for taking your time for the chat, and all the best for the future with Right Said Fred. All the best for your future music plans, and well, hopefully we'll see you with another big hit very soon.
You never know. And stranger things happened. Absolutely. All right, mate. Okay, good. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Richard. Take care.
All right.
Bye.
Take it easy. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.